Hi, good afternoon, everyone. This is Ashley Wilbon from NQF. Just wanted to... Wanted to welcome you to the Resource Use Steering Committee conference call this afternoon. We're going to be just going to go ahead and dive right in. If I can get my slides to turn here. Today, we're going to just do a brief project update and follow up to our in-person meeting last week. And we'll review the scientific acceptability rating process, just kind of in follow-up to the in-person meeting. We will complete the feasibility evaluation for the two NGINX measures that we started discussing at the in-person meeting, which was the 1599, the non-condition specific resource use measure, and 1595, the ETG-based diagnosis measure. We'll also review the 1591, which is ETG-based CHF, 1594, ETG-based CAD, both in NGINX. The cardiovascular diabetes TAP evaluated these measures yesterday, so we've done a quick turnaround of their ratings and discussion, and we will we'll share that with you today, and you will have your discussion today, and we'll hopefully wrap up all of the cardiovascular diabetes measures today. And the next time we would have you guys together, we'll be evaluating the measures from cycle two. So just a brief update, particularly for those, I think all the steering committee members are on the phone, we're probably at the meeting, but for the public and anyone else who's on the phone. As a result of the meeting last week, or 2 weeks ago now, I guess, the committee recommended four measures. 1598, which was a total resource use population-based index, and a complementary measure, which was a total cost of care population-based index as well, for both from health partners, were endorsed. There was also two measures from NCQA that were recommended. 1577, a relative resource use for diabetic patients, and relative resource use for cardiovascular patients. So we've got a total of four recommended at this point, and we're forging forward. Is Helen on the phone? Okay. Heidi, are you there?
I am here, yes.
Okay. I know Helen wanted to talk a little bit about the ABMS measures. Did you want to talk, or do you want me to go ahead and discuss those? I can do that.
Why don't you do that? I'll jump in and let me see if she's around.
Okay. So we had a bit of a development this week with from the ABMS measure development group. They have decided to withdraw their measures from the project at this time. They felt that they needed more testing before they were put through a rigorous evaluation process. So what we want to do for the evaluations that have been done up to this point is to provide that feedback back to the development team so that they can use that in their continued measure refinement and continued testing process. So what that does for the project at this point is it does significantly cut the number of measures that need to be reviewed in terms of rating and recommendation. We will be asking, though, for the remainder of the measures that haven't been reviewed yet, particularly by the pulmonary TAP and by the steering committee, that you do still provide some feedback on them, and we will have some structured forums in which we will have some discussions on those measures so that they can benefit from that input. And I think through the review process so far, we found that everyone was really excited about the measures and really liked the measures and the concepts that they had put together and would like to see those have some more work on them in order to be put forth again. So, again, we appreciate everyone's effort in reviewing those up to this point, and your input is definitely valued.
And Ashley, if I could just add in, this is Helen Burston. I've had numerous discussions with Kevin Weiss over the last week or so, and, you know, he very much appreciates the positive reinforcement for the important measure concepts where those measures are trying to go, but he also recognizes that there's, additional work needed to be done in terms of testing. So I think our thought would be we're not going to have you actually rate them or approve them or disapprove them, but I think it would be worth, particularly given all the effort on both sides, both the committee side and ABMS's side, to have an opportunity for the committees to offer feedback to Kevin and his team so that before they go test the measures, if there are some opportunities for improvement, that he could take advantage of that shared learning. So that's our what we've worked out with Kevin and ABMS to date. Happy to answer questions if anybody has any.
Okay. Just don't know if there's any questions on that. We do have our final TAP meeting with the pulmonary TAP next week on Tuesday, so that will be the last TAP meeting for the project. As a result of the ABMS measures coming out of the process for formal review at this point, we do have some updates to the conference call schedule that we had just sent out. So please make note on your calendar that we're going to be canceling the July 28th call that was scheduled. And I know you guys are all very disappointed that you have two more hours to open up on your calendar. We will keep the September 14th call. And we'll use that time to have an open discussion on the remaining ABMS measures so that you guys can provide some input that we can forward on to the ABMS development team. The Tuesday, September 20th call will be canceled as well. So please make note of that on your calendar. And we will also be sending out updates for those a follow-up email to this conference call. So who aren't on the call, they can
make. What was the second one that was canceled?
The Tuesday, September 20th. Okay. So just a quick sneak peek into what we're thinking for the next steering committee meeting in August, that you would complete the evaluation and recommendations for the remaining seven measures. We've got a couple bone joint measures from NGENX, and we've got some pulmonary measures from NGENX and NCQA. So that steering committee meeting will be focused on completing the review of those measures. We'll have some time to hopefully do some input on the ABMS measures. And we'd like to have some time also on the agenda for the committee, particularly having been through this two-year process at this point, to offer us, to kind of brainstorm on some lessons learned and recommendations for next steps and how we might move forward as we continue to bring resource use measures into our portfolio and continue to evaluate them in the future. So we're looking forward to that. I won't spend time on this, but these are the timelines now for the Cycle 1 and Cycle 2 review of the measures. And I'm going to transition quickly into the process that we'll use today to review the measures. But I would like to just pause for a second. Does anyone have questions about the kind of logistical project stuff before we move into the measure review process?
Ashley, I wonder if it would be possible to take 1 minute and identify who all we have on the call.
Sure, we can do that.
Thank you, Tom.
So you have the committee membership, so can we just maybe run down from the top?
Sure. I don't believe we have Bruce, Tom, Paul Barnett. Are you there? Jack Bohan, I'm pretty sure he said he couldn't make it. Jephtha Curtis?
Yep, I'm on.
Okay, great. Curtis Elward?
I'm here.
Bill Golden? I think he said he couldn't make it. Lisa Graybert?
Here.
Ethan Hall? Ann Hendrich? Tom Lee? Jack Needleman?
I'm here.
Okay. Doris Peter? Mary Kay O'Neill? David Pinson?
Here.
Steve? Oh, I'm sorry. Dr. Pinson? Okay. Steve Phillips?
Here.
David Redfern?
Present.
Hi. Bill Rich?
Here.
Great. Jeff Rich? Barb Rudolph? Joe Stefanski?
I'm here.
All right. Jim Weinstein? And Laura Shinagahara? Okay. So
And Ashley, this is Sally. I'm also on the call just for your records.
Okay, thanks, Sally. Any other questions before we move forward? Okay. So we'll start with the feasibility discussion for 1595 and 1599. And I'll help Tom and I will guide you through that discussion. For 1591 and 1594, which will be in some ways kind of new review for you guys, you haven't started reviewing these measures yet. We'll have the developer do brief introductions on them, and then we will share, we have the visual, the graph that we showed similar to the in-person meeting that will show you how the TAP has rated each of the sub-criteria for each of the, overall criteria. So we'll do that for importance and scientific acceptability, usability, and feasibility. We also have Dr. Jephtha Curtis on the phone, who was on the conference call yesterday with the cardiovascular diabetes TAP, and he will help to summarize and give rationale for some of the ratings that the TAP provided. We also had assigned, particularly for 1591, a lead discussant for some of the sub-criteria. So if those individuals are on the phone and would like to offer input, we can do that as well. And for usability and feasibility, I think some of the discussion that we've had from the previous discussions on NGENX measures will probably apply to this. And Tom can guide you guys through that discussion to see if there's anything new or different for these measures that would need to be discussed while we're on the call. I would also like to point out that we did send you links via email to have you vote and submit your final recommendations on the measure. So we'll have you, you can have that up during the call and submit them during the call. We won't be able to show them in real time just based on the technology that we have at this time, but we would encourage you to do it while you have time to sit down and do it during the discussion if you're able to and you're at a computer. So those are the links, and we can resend them if anyone needs them. So again, we're going to go through a systematic review process. We'll sequentially address the criteria, and we'll be evaluating the measure as submitted. So I just wanted to do a brief overview of the rating of the reliability and validity. I know the rating system that we use and the process that we use at the in-person meeting and the use of the algorithm and that table that we were referring you guys to, there was probably some confusion over how that applied and how your ratings for reliability and validity fed into that table. So what we're going to have you do going forward is to have the steering committee rate the overall reliability and validity on each measure. Even though the TAP has done that, we want the steering committee to do that as well. And then we'll ask the steering committee to again vote on overall scientific acceptability, which is a yes-no kind of pass-fail criteria. And then what we'll do is staff will also apply our algorithm that we've implemented into NQF process. And then when we report, when we draft the draft report, we'll be including both what the steering committee voted as well as what the algorithm result would have been based on your ratings. So just to kind of have a process clarification there and how we're going to be doing that going forward. So again,
Could I just clarify one thing on that, Ashley?
Sure, Tom.
What that means for the group is that that grid will drive an independent score for scientific acceptability. So we might need to keep that in mind as we rate reliability and validity, and in fact, in some sense, weight the elements within it ourselves. Because if somebody thinks the thing isn't scientifically acceptable, then it will be more important to indicate that by either the reliability or the validity score as you score that. Otherwise, we'll end up with a kind of mixed scoring.
Uh-huh.
Does that make sense to people?
Yeah.
Tom, this is Tarun. Ashley and I will go through the grid, so the committee will be aware of exactly how the grid will work. We just wanted to clarify this just so that we have it going forward.
Right. I think this is a perfectly reasonable way, but and the backstory to this is that in the interim from the meeting, there was some consideration that what we should have done as a committee was simply have applied the grid for the reliability and validity scores and not voted on scientific acceptance. But, of course, we did vote on scientific acceptance, and at least in one instance, our overall scientific score didn't exactly match the way the grid would have come out. And so we can, this is a good compromise to have both elements to go forward with our recommendations. But it does mean that if you really think the scientific acceptance is going to be a no, then it probably would be good to also indicate that via which element it was that caused you to rate it that way, either reliability or validity, and it requires a low score in order to do that.
Right. Thank you, Tom, for that clarification.
Okay.
Any questions on that? We realize it can be confusing, and we're doing our best to make it as clear as possible. So if you have any questions along the way, you know, please ask, because if you're wondering, there's probably someone else who has the same question. So, okay, thanks. So for the high rating for reliability and validity, what you're saying, if you rate something high, is that the specifications are unambiguous. Anyone who would apply that all the measure specifications are unambiguous and they're likely to consistently identify who is included and excluded from the target population. Also, that they have evidence of reliability of both the data elements and the measure score. Okay? For validity, a high rating means that the specifications are consistent with the measure intent and with the measure focus that they identified in the importance criteria, and that they have evidence of validity of both data elements and the measure score, and that the measure score they've used the appropriate type of validity testing, and the result is within acceptable norms. So that also includes that they've identified threats to validity and that they've addressed those threats. Okay? So for a moderate rating, for reliability, you're saying that all the measure specifications are unambiguous and that there's empirical evidence that the reliability testing has been done on either the data elements or the measure score. They don't have to have it on both. And then similarly for validity, the measure specifications reflect the intent that they've cited and that they have evidence of validity on either the measure score or the data elements. Or that they have systematically assessed face validity of the measure score. Okay? So, and that also includes that they've identified threats to validity and addressed those. For a low rating on reliability and validity, it means that one or more of the specifications are ambiguous. There's potential for confusion on who's identified in the target population, how the resources or costs are being measured, or how to compute the score. All right? Or that there's the evidence, the empirical evidence they provided is unreliable for either the data elements or the measure score. And similarly for validity, the measure specifications do not reflect the intent, or the evidence they provided on validity they provided an invalid approach to proving validity of their data elements or of the measure score. And they have not identified threats to validity, and they have not been empirically assessed. For an insufficient evidence rating, it means that you don't have the information in front of you need to determine whether or not it would be high, moderate, or low, or that they've used an inappropriate method for validity testing or inadequate assessment of face validity. So that is how we would frame your ratings of high, moderate, low. And I'm going to let Tarun kind of walk you guys through the grid.
Okay. So
can I just ask the question about insufficient evidence? It's Steve Phillips. I mean, is that considered basically the equivalent of a low rating? I mean, if it's not there, then it's kind of a fail, or is there an opportunity then to go back and submit more evidence?
This is Helen. Certainly, it's always a possibility if there's additional information to be gotten to try to bump up an insufficient evidence. That's certainly something we can try to do in the timeline of the project.
And Helen, I have one question. This is Tom. The validity and reliability criteria were taken to a large degree from the quality review process that's been going on for years, right?
Yes. So the way reliability and validity, at least the scoring mechanism, came out of the work our testing task force did last year. Yes.
Okay. And the only point to that is that what did not exist in the quality arena was this attribution question of is the measure being properly attributed to the group that it's purporting to report on, which I don't think really ever existed in the quality world. I mean, if a hospital is doing heart attacks, they're responsible for aspirin, and there's no confusion about who the measures being attributed here to, but in the cost, these cost things, this attribution question does come up, and so I assume that attribution questions would fall into this reliability and validity thing, even though there's no explicit statement about attribution in here.
Yeah, it's definitely tricky. The whole attribution issue and quality measures overall is pretty unclear. I mean, in some ways, the way we handle level of analysis or shared accountability for like a readmission measure is somewhat analogous. I think what's different in these measures is an actual quantification of the degree of attribution to the different providers, which I think is different.
Right. Well, and it's that's what I'm saying. I think it's almost unique to this cost world that we're trying to grapple with.
Yes.
And therefore, we probably, in fact, in our statements about reliability and validity probably should have added something specific about attribution, but I think the committee has been doing that as we analyzed the ones we did in the face-to-face meeting.
Yeah, Sally may want to weigh in on that because I know there were a lot of discussions in the early phases as the sub-criteria in scientific acceptability were thought through of at least asking for the information on attribution but not necessarily considering it. Sally, do you want to give any insights there?
Sure. There's a couple of things in thinking about attribution. There's some similarities, certainly, in quality measures to some extent, and I think Helen already touched on this. So whom you're going to hold accountable, even in the quality world, there's usually a request by the experts that who the measure is being attributed to or which level has some kind of control over it. As your example, Tom, aspirin in the hospital, that seems to make sense. And the resource use measure, I think some of the discomfort also is because it's new, but also there's this other level of attribution, which is how do you split up the resource use measures among physicians or health plans? So there's the level, so as I just mentioned, physicians or health plans, but there's also are you identifying you, the measure developer, the appropriate peer group? So is this resource use measure appropriate for a peer group of cardiac surgeons? So there's layered questions that come up in resource use measures that are new in many ways. I say new without meaning they're totally new because they do come up in quality measures. When we were thinking about how this would play out in the evaluation process, two things came up. One was that the steering committee last year stated that they wanted the measure developers to have the ability to provide options, that in different parts of the country, they may want to take that resource use measure. They may be fine with the peer group, but they may want to change the attribution a little bit, but that they wanted the measure developers to provide clear guidance that had some logic behind it. It made sense given the measure they were proposing. They didn't want it to stay silent. So we've allowed for some flexibility in the collection of that information from the developers. As far as when you're evaluating what the measure developers have submitted, whether it's specifications, so they only give one approach and that's it, or guidance where they're providing options, you are right, Tom, that we would expect you to think of that in terms of validity. So are the attribution approaches, are the peer groups that they've selected for the resource use measure under consideration valid? Do they make sense? So if it's a resource use measure for pediatric asthma and they're saying the peer group is cardiac surgeons, you might say that hurts the validity of the measure.
Okay, so it even though it's not specified in these criteria, et cetera, it's appropriate to consider the attribution questions in the validity realm.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, okay. But to take that extreme example, I mean, that's a case where I would say the attribution is clearly wrong. Now, if we think that they've got the resources correctly measured, that they've done an incredibly good job of identifying asthma care resources, so that part is right, and the patient level stuff is right, and the attribution is wrong, is that low or is that medium? Is the attribution so central to these measures that if we don't believe the attribution algorithm, we should reject them?
Well, I think that's sort of that's certainly a question, and we can debate that in theory, or we could wait and see how it applies in specific cases. I guess in my mind, again, it falls back to, is this being used for improvement efforts, or is this being used for public reporting? And the public reporting piece is what, for me, makes it, if somebody's going to publish this group of pediatricians versus that group of cardiac surgeons on pediatric asthma, it's going to be invalid. The what is produced for the public will, in fact, be invalid. So for me personally, the attribution thing is a critical factor, but mainly because of the hurdle that we have that we've all agree is appropriate around that this is for public reporting and not just quality improvement.
Okay.
But that's just my opinion. I mean, people are clearly free to have their own opinions, and others may differ about that.
I would just offer one piece of guidance, I guess. This is Tarun from NQF. Just want to remind you that the attribution is we allow the option of either a guideline or a specification. So if the developer specifies as a guideline, it is an option in the tool, and thus it should be evaluated in that sense, because we did offer them the option of a guideline versus specification. So the specification would be built into the measure as opposed to a guideline, which would allow some degree of flexibility.
I guess, Tarun, the thing I'm confused a little bit about that is the specification seems to me to be so central to the thing. If there's merely a guideline, but the guideline has broad ambiguity, and let's use the kind of extreme and ridiculous example, but a good one for the sake of trying to sort this out. You know, we would prefer you compare only pediatricians to pediatricians, but basically you could, in fact, or pediatric pulmonologist to one pulmonologist, but in fact you could use any pediatrician to any pediatrician in the actual use of the thing. You could have somebody, in fact, applying a cardiac surgeon against against a pulmonologist, and you'd have a really completely invalid outcome.
Tom, I agree with you 100%. I think one of the challenges, though, as we want to, you know, as we sort of try to maintain some internal consistency in the process, is that because the process was set up with the guidelines and specification, a developer who offers the option of multiple attribution approaches and doesn't really give a lot more detail beyond that should be judged similarly to a measure that offers sort of a detailed description of one option of an approach and also specifies that as a guideline. Because they did not select it as a specification in the current criteria that we've established as a steering committee. So, agreed, all those principles are important to consider, and I would encourage you to consider them as you see fit. But as we sort of think about the criteria, because they've allowed the flexibility in the specifications versus guidelines, we have to consider that specifying or allowing it as a guideline allows a certain level of flexibility, or should be evaluated in that sense.
Okay. Well, my suggestion is that we beat this up enough, and we'll probably continue with every individual measure to revisit our own notions of what constitutes scientific validity in the face of measures that don't, you know, that don't have an extensive peer review basis to them. But rather than continuing to talk about this at 30,000 feet, Ashley, should we kind of move to the measures?
Yep, that's fair. I'm just want to take a quick second on the matrix here, just to understand how our internal NQF algorithm works. So if we have a high validity rating and a high or moderate reliability rating, that would pass scientific acceptability. While a high validity rating and a low reliability rating would be a no recommendation. Moderate, and this is, I do want to spend some time making sure we all are clear about this, a moderate validity rating and a moderate to high reliability rating would be recommended for endorsement, whereas a moderate validity rating and a low reliability rating would be a no for recommendation for scientific acceptability. And finally, low in validity and low in reliability would be no for scientific acceptability, as Tom, you said right from the beginning of this conversation. So really, the threshold here is low. If there is a low rating, then that's really the only, that's really going to drive this to essentially a no, on passing scientific acceptability. Are there any questions about this? Okay, thanks.
So to Tom's point, I think we'll just go ahead now and transition into the actual measure evaluation process. And why don't we start with the feasibility discussion? And what I'll do is bring up the feasibility sub-criteria, and we can walk through each of those. Tom, I was going to run by you. Do you think it's, rather than discussing each of the measures individually, we could just kind of discuss feasibility?
Yep, it's applicable to all four of these NGENX measures.
Okay, that sounds good.
So we can shortcut this a little bit by having basically one feasibility study, because the questions, I think, will be the same for all four of these.
Right.
So if people will recall, the 1599 and 1595, we did a full discussion at the face-to-face meeting on importance, scientific acceptability, and usability, and we tabled the feasibility discussion because we did not have the cost. And now we have the cost, and that, I think that was the major issue that needed resolution, possibly among some other issues, but I think that's mainly what's on the table here in relationship to feasibility.
Yeah, and Tom, this is Helen. So, the cost data was the one thing we were missing the last time you met. So, it's one of the it's a sub criteria under feasibility, but you should now be able to look at the whole criterion, including the specific one around how the costs affect what get factored in.
Okay, thanks. So, for those of you that are on the webinar, I have up on the screen the four feasibility criteria. 4A and 4B are ones we've probably not spent a lot of time on. 4A asks whether or not the required data elements are generated routinely, which obviously these measures use admin data, so we don't spend time on that. This 4B focuses on whether or not the data elements are available electronically. Again, for admin data, not really an issue. So we'll just ask to focus your time on 4C and 4D. 4C looks at whether or not the measure has addressed or there are susceptibilities to inaccuracies, errors, or unintended consequences, and whether or not the developer has identified those and how they can be minimized, monitored, and detected.
All right, so this is open for discussion.
Well,
do we have the TAP report on this, by the way, Ashley, just to get us started?
Well, the...
Which code are we starting with?
4C.
4C.
The data is not inaccurate or et cetera, basically.
Yes, I have. You guys have done a discussion of 1599, so you've done an in-depth review of 1599, so you can kind of start off with your knowledge of that, and I can pull up the TAP ratings of 4C for 1595 if you want to do that.
Well, that's fine. I was just wondering if we had a TAP thing on feasibility for everything other than the cost. Or not?
Not specifically, no.
Okay,
they
then it's
not probably going to help much in this.
Okay, so this is on us. So it's open for discussion.
Well, we've got the same issue of the carve out here, for and the availability of carved out data on mental health and pharmacy costs. The Ingenix people, at least, my recollection is the Ingenix people did not speak to mental health carve outs. Did speak to drug carve outs and said the way they were addressing that in this measure was by stratifying by whether or not the pharmacy data was available in the estimates of resource use.
Jack, do you think that these issues are sufficiently well addressed in this to enable a positive determination on around 4C?
Well, in contrast with, say, the NCQA folks who said, we go back, we audit, we know these are supposed to be included, our plans are supposed to get it, so we had their assertion that the numbers were always there. Here we've got the Ingenix people are not saying the numbers were always there. What they're saying is, at least with respect to pharmacy, you can stratify and look at the resource estimates where we've got pharmacy and where we don't. I'm a little concerned about the mental health side of this in a non-specific condition thing, given how many people suffer from depression in the country in any given year, and the role of those drugs, both drugs, not just drugs, but therapy in that area. But the question is how much error does that produce in these estimates, and how systematic is it?
And what's your judgment?
I'm at the moment floating between low and medium. I certainly wouldn't go higher than medium on this particular item,
given those issues.
Folks have not seemed to have thought about the carve-out issues enough to solve them.
Okay. All right. And then the other issue that occurs to me, and I can't remember whether you talked about this last time, and this one is literally almost a matter of one's philosophy, is what are the various inaccuracies in administrative data generally? Coding inaccuracies, coding variation, this, that, and the other.
Plan use, add that to the list of stuff.
Right. But it's almost an act of faith. It's almost an act of faith as to whether you believe that's a serious impediment or just the nature of doing business using administrative data. Other comments on this?
One other issue here, Tom, this is Bill Rich, is at least they talk about sample size, and said small sample sizes are customarily dealt with. There's no discussion like we had last time of what statistical criteria apply to small sample sizes, how they're dealt with, or how they define them. But I'm favorably impressed that at least they address the issue, but it's not clear in my mind what they actually do with small sample sizes, whether they get published or not.
Okay. Other issues related to susceptibility to inaccuracies, errors, or unintended consequences.
So what did the TAP say? I'm still struggling to find that document about this issue.
Yeah, Ashley, did the TAP weigh in on 4C?
For 1595, they did. If you recall, 1595...
That's fine, because it's the same on all of these. So did they weigh in on feasibility for any of these Ingenix measures?
Yes, and I can bring that up. But again, it'll be – give me 1 second here.
Yeah, let's jump that. So, I mean, while Ashley's looking for the formal documentation, I mean, I think we struggled with it from start to finish in that, and it overlaps with what we were discussing with validity for these specific measures. There's a wide range of opinions as to how accurate they are at measuring what they're purporting to measure. And there are some people who believe that they were, and there are some people who believe that they weren't. And there, I think, was a fairly wide range on the votes, although I think overall it was sort of a moderate, that there was some good faith that, that in fact it is in general measuring what it's supposed to be measuring, at least for diabetes.
That's sort of a
small,
validity.
But, what's that?
That's a validity issue.
Yeah, no, but I think it had to do with, but it had to do with, at the end of the day, in terms of, I guess, feasibility and the susceptibilities to errors, that question of you know, if it's not valid, is it feasible, or is it susceptible
yeah.
to errors? I think the other part was, you know, as you addressed or someone brought up the issues of the small volumes, basically there's really just the guideline as to how to approach it, but there was really no content that supported that approach or demonstrated how that approach could be used, although they may have submitted some documentation thereafter that does support it.
All right, well, here's the vote on the screen. For those of you that have it, you can see it. But for those of you that don't, the tap on 1595, and again, I think these are, we're for the purpose of this discussion, considering these to be fairly similar, if not identical. The vote was 4 low, 2 medium, and 2 high on 4C, susceptible to inaccuracy. So I think that probably reflects the discussion we're having here as well, although I haven't heard anybody, at least on this conversation yet, speak to the high side on this one.
Yeah, I was just wondering what those four low votes were. You know, what is it about the sample size and attribution stuff?
I think it had to do with mainly about the attribution, in that even though it's a guideline, and again, I think Tarun's comments were useful and might have been helpful earlier. But we weren't really sure what to do with attribution and where to put it into the equation here. But if you take the worst case scenario, which I think the TAP did in this particular discussion of the diabetes measure, if you were to apply it to a single physician, are you getting a useful result or is it an accurate result?
Okay, and in that regard, it does overlap the feasibility conversation.
Exactly. I mean, they're hard to differentiate.
They are, particularly on 4C.
One of the issues here, Jeff, and this is Bill Rich again, is the reason it's not specified is that different people take these and use them in different ways, whether they're self-assured or planned. So they each define, you know, what a low number is. So I think that's probably why it's fairly generic. Maybe some of the staff could comment on that. But that was my major issue, was low sample size, and that's been our evaluation in the past we looked at.
Okay. And then any other comments on 4C? Then let's do the last part on the feasibility, which would be 4D. And just as long as – actually, leave that on the screen for 2 seconds because we can give you the TAP vote on this was 5 high, 2 medium, and 1 low on data collection strategy can be implemented. But they didn't. The TAP did not have the benefit of this cost question. And Helen, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is where the question about the cost of the of access to the data becomes relevant to the feasibility point,
yes.
Right?
Exactly. Yep. So the one sub criteria.
Right. So Ashley, bring up 4D back on the screen if you could.
So Tom, just to backpedal this, Paul Barnett, just a moment. I would just observe in terms of 4C and the unintended consequences that I do feel a little bit better about this episode-based method than something that could be, that it seems less prone to gaming than we were talking about some of the other measures. That is, there's not much you can do too much to manipulate the start or end of an episode. That would seem to be beyond, in order to game the measure. So
right.
Unlike something like the per person per, you know, capita per year, you could game it just by bringing in people for, you know, well checks and
right.
game a measure. This kind of the sophistication of this would seem to preclude that. So you're saying nobody seemed to have too much positive to say. I just point that out. There may be other drawbacks, but there is, you know, because of this sophistication, it does have that
okay.
advantage. Now, the question is it worth this much money? Does that make it feasible? Is
yeah.
the next
okay.
issue,
all right.
yes.
All right, well, thanks for the positive comments, because if, in fact, the vote turns out positive, the staff will be wondering, all we heard were these various negatives, how'd the vote turn out that way? So that's helpful. So can we, if anybody would like to further comment on 4C? Okay, then let's go to 4D. And again, the real issue here I think, is the cost. And again, I'm trying to get us to that. And now on the screen, for those of you that have it, the webinar is the small, medium, and large client range for MDs and small, medium, and large for covered lives if it were applied to a health plan. And for physicians, it's small is $70,000, medium is $90,000, and large is $110,000 annual cost. And large is over 2,000 physicians, and small is under 800. And then for health plans, it's small, medium, and large is $90,000, $115,000, and $135,000 per year. Small is less than 400,000 covered lives, and large is over 1 million covered lives. And then there's a little governmental discount for the health plan piece. So that's the general frame of reference on what this thing costs. And Ashley, the one relevant comparator that I think we have in terms of trying to be internally consistent was the Hopkins
ACG.
Yeah, ACG thing. And what do you recall approximately the range of cost on that?
I don't off the top of my head, although I believe the distribution of pricing was a little bit wider, so it started at a lower amount, and so between low and high, so like between a small practice and a medium size, you know, it started at a lower amount, and then the moderate was a little bit higher. So it's a little bit, it's hard for me to say, but again, I think to try to steer away from, I understand your point to internal consistency, but as much as possible, we want to try to make sure we're evaluating the measures. Evaluating the measures individually and try not to, you know, it's a fine line. I understand your dilemma, but just to kind of, you know.
Oh, but was the frame of reference anywhere the same? I don't think anybody on the group is going to go, wow, that one was 35 and this one is 50, therefore this one's too expensive. But I personally think there is some notion of internal consistency that if that one was 2,000 and we passed it and this one's 100,000, we might have a discussion. But if that one was, in fact, in the same general range and we approved it, I'm not sure on what basis we would have then to disapprove this one based on cost.
Okay.
That's all, at least for me.
Right, I understand.
Because I do think we are trying to achieve some level of internal consistency and fairness about our thing, and we shouldn't, you know, one day do something that's exactly in contradistinction to something we did the previous day because we forgot what we did.
Yeah,
this is David. I think the prices were about the same.
That's what I think, but I'm just trying to.
They're both way too high.
Okay.
I don't think there was any material difference between the two products.
Okay, well that's what I think too.
The major concern was the lack of transparency rather than the pricing with the OCG things.
All right, but well, let's discuss though the issue about the cost on this because again, you know, Helen in particular has brought this one up in particular in relationship to Ingenix. I think one other difference between this one and the ACG one was, I mean, this is a license fee to Ingenix to be able to use their proprietary system, which I think is slightly different than the other one. But let's open up the general question. What do people think about the cost issue here on this?
Consistency from Ingenix. If I could just caveat that last comment about the cost. The cost that we provided is not only for the licensure of the proprietary software. It's for all the measures. There's over 558 ETGs in our product. The software, documentation, support, control reports, and other outputs, it is not just the cost for that one single measure and the proprietary nature of that. I just wanted to be clear on that.
All right. Thank you for that clarification. Point well made. Open for discussion.
I'm just curious, what do the three different tabs represent? One says ETG, one says ETG-ERG. And the other one says EDG PEG.
Sure. Some of the measures that we submitted for endorsement consideration are related to ETG only. For example, diabetes is an ETG-specific relationship. We have our non-condition-specific population-based measure, which is composed of both ETG and ERG, which is our risk assessment grouper and our episode treatment grouper. And then we have another measure that we submitted for in consideration that involves our PEG and ETG methods, and that would be our hip and knee replacement.
But the comment says that the pricing is for the entire suite, so you have to buy the whole thing to do any part of this, in essence.
Well, the pricing is for all measures. So we have six products within the Symmetry suite. ETG is one product in that suite. ERG is another, PRG is another. So depending on which measure, you would have to either select one product from the suite or two, ETG and ERG or ETG and PEG.
So you add together, if there's more than one measure, then you start adding together these amounts that are under the different tabs?
Again, ETG has multiple measures in the product. We're talking about products, software products. And so ETG has over 500, measures or episodes. Diabetes, CHF, CAD, depression, fractures, all of those are inclusive of the cost.
Right, but if I could clarify, I mean, I take your point is well made. You get the whole package, but in fact, if you were an entity that wanted to use this particular measure and this particular measure only, you would get a whole bunch of other stuff that you might or might not want to use.
That is correct. We do not provide pricing for one single measure. We do not provide our software for one single measure. The measure is a component of the whole.
And can they be used without? Could any one of these be used without availing yourself of all of the technical support of Ingenix in order to be able to implement it?
We do not license the measure without licensing the software itself. It's a comprehensive package.
Well, but I'm going one step further. In order to actually use the software, would you not need the resources of Ingenix to basically consult and help you figure out how to use it?
You could go that route if you want. I mean, that's included in the cost. We don't break that out.
Is it usable without that help?
It would be complicated, but sure, it would be usable.
This is David Redfern. Having gone through this process many years ago, it is technically possible to take their documentation and work through it. It's challenging, though. But you don't have to have the handholding. You could actually read the documentation and probably figure it out, but it's difficult.
Well, but this gets to feasibility a little bit. I mean, is that
right?
Really feasible?
It's probably not ideal.
Is it feasible? With whatever definition of feasible we want to apply here.
It's possible, but not very feasible.
Okay.
Right. So my question was, is if you chose two measures and one was ETG-ERG and the other required ETG-PEG, you'd actually have to pay, if you were a medium-sized payer, $150,000 for one and $150,000 per year for the other.
That is not correct. The PEG and ERG are percentages that are added on when you buy ETG. So it is not an additive effect. It would be a percentage of the cost of ETG.
Well, but just to clarify, it is additive. It's just not it's not geometric.
That is correct. I apologize. Yes.
Yeah,
so
you would pay more. It's just it doesn't double or triple.
So
you wouldn't pay for ETG twice. In the tables that are provided, those are independent instances where you would buy ETG and ERG, and then you would buy ETG and PEG. You could also buy in one package ETG, ERG, and PEG, and that would be not additive of those two costs.
Well, it seems like the ERG adds $35,000 a year for the medium payer.
Right.
And PEG would add another $35,000 per year.
That is
if
correct.
You needed both.
So it would be 10 plus 35 plus 35.
Right.
The way this would work is for $15.99, you have to license ETGs and ERGs because you have to get to that ERG to get the risk score.
Right.
For $15.95, all you need to license is ETGs because you're only interested in diabetes. But what you're getting when you license ETGs is you get a module, a grouper, that will generate all the various 500 different ETGs, not just the diabetes one. And the one consign, I know Cherry has indicated that Ingenix doesn't license just individual ETGs, but all you're interested in measure 1595 is diabetes. Yet you're buying a product, an expensive product that does everything, that has the whole thing. I just would ask Ingenix whether they have any, have ever thought about the fact of creating a pricing module in which it, the model runs and it just spits out the diabetes ETGs, if you're not interested in anything else, and whether that would have an effect on price. I mean, I think, frankly, my opinion on all of this and the ACF stuff, too, is that this is so expensive that it would be prohibitive. If you're not already licensing Ingenix, maybe you're licensing the MedStat grouper. Why would any big carrier that has, you know, a million-plus members want to pony up all this money when they already have an existing ETG, existing episode methodology in place that's not ETGs just to run the one measure? That's my question.
Well, and another question about this is if you're going to do it just to run the diabetes, wouldn't you have to run all your claims data through the system and, you know, get it all cleaned up so that it can run through it?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, you'd have to do that because you have to be able to distinguish diabetes from all the other things.
But it's only about, you know, less than 10% of it probably has to do with diabetes, so that kind of makes it not so feasible. That seems a little bit cumbersome. In other words, to look
it, is, it is. Having,
so
having
100% of the data in order to look at 10% of the data, that seems to
actually, if I can, this is Dan Dunn from Ingenix, but you would have to run all the data to find the patients who have diabetes and then to sort out, you know, which services are related to diabetes or not. So I don't think there's any way around processing an entire population to do this measure.
But it would be fair to say that this is not a trivial exercise.
I think any of these measures that you're likely considering, well, trivial exercise, any of this is work, but any of the measures you're considering, you know, if I was a health plan or a provider organization, I would be preparing all of my data for processing to I'd be able to identify episodes for a certain condition or describe a patient from a, you know, population-based perspective.
Is there any distinction among the group about the pricing and the feasibility vis-a-vis application of this at the health plan level versus the application of this at the physician level? Is there any differentiation, or is it the same issues equally applicable?
Well, the small, definitionally small physician group is very large.
Yeah.
So, I mean, whether you're looking at a group of 2 or 10 or even 100, you're looking at the same $90,000.
Has it been, my one question I have for Ingenix, has it been used at a small, and let's, for the purposes of this description, small being maybe more like a couple of hundred physician group, has it been applied in that setting?
We do have physician groups that utilize the product. The challenge is those physician groups having all of the data they would need to run a successful run of the product. And that would include, as you can see from our specifications, you know, lab data, hospital data, pharmacy data. So I think.
And the use of other physicians, right? If they got
right.
care from a different outside that group, then it's not very comparable, would it?
No, it would not be.
So, I mean, there is a, you know, I would say that the product can be used. Larger physician groups have more accessibility to that level of data and therefore can run the product successfully or more successfully. But, you know, we do have smaller employer groups that are more self-contained that could have access to that data.
that could.
Well, I get it on the employer side or even on the health plan side, and the size isn't such an issue there because you have all the data. What's the and frankly, you probably have the IT infrastructure to as Dan said, process your data and get it through the system. Most physician groups, many physician groups don't, and so can you share with us an example of without I don't know whether this is proprietary or whatever, but what an example of a physician group that's using the tool?
Do we need to name them, Tom, or can we just describe them?
Yeah, I think describe. If you're not comfortable naming them, just describe them and what it was to get it set up and go on.
Yeah, and maybe the tricky thing here, which I know people keep bringing up, is often when this is implemented, people are looking for not just a diabetes measure, they're looking for, support across the clinical breadth of medicine, especially if it's a multi-specialty organization.
Right.
So, there aren't any, obviously, that are implementing just to support a diabetes.
Right, understood.
Measure. Okay, a couple of examples. And I'll skip the large provider entities, like in California, for example. But, there are some, multi-specialty organizations who have, decided to take on risk or do improvement, who are, taking, licensing the tool and are working with either because they have global risk arrangements, they have all the data, or working with their health plan partners to pull information together. There's not a lot of those, not the norm, but there are those organizations, probably a little bigger than 100 physicians. And maybe it'll help you on the other side. I don't know of any 20 physician multi-specialty practice or even primary care practice that's taking this on.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions from the group?
Yes, this one's to NQF, not NGenX, and I understand, we're looking at specific measures and the cost of implementing specific measures, but Tom's question about comparability to ATGs was one example, but what's been the experience in terms of endorsing proprietary measures with price tags in other measure sets? Where do the numbers we're looking at here fall into the range of what's been considered and either accepted or not accepted as acceptable cost?
Yeah, this is Helen. We've had a very limited experience with bringing in proprietary measures. We had a couple of measures we looked at in the past from a couple of proprietary groups in our outcome safety project a couple years ago. The measures didn't make it through, so that there wasn't really, for other reasons, more on the scientific acceptability side. So there wasn't really, didn't come down to as much the feasibility discussion. And I don't know what the comparable data is, but we're literally talking just, a handful of measures. We currently don't have any measures endorsed that I know of that are proprietary with fees. But again, we knew walking into this resource use project that this was a very different space.
So we're in sort of uncharted waters here a little bit.
Yep.
So the nine of us are going
to
get
to respond to my questions before about the lack of specificity about how they handle small sample sizes.
That was Bill. Small sample size question. When Bill raised that earlier, I don't think the NGenX folks might or might not have been on the call.
I was, Tom, so I can help here. So I believe we followed up with, I think it, from our general response, which you probably have in front of you, was, the issue around small sample size and obviously a source of potential misinterpretation and accuracy was the use of confidence intervals when making comparisons either to a benchmark or across providers. And I believe we followed up with the actual formulas that you would use for a confidence interval that we were proposing. And in terms of, we actually didn't couple that with a minimum number of observations, but, we could certainly do that, but I think if you had a sample size of one, obviously a very significant confidence interval. It's not a very useful number and wouldn't be used for anyone put any weight on it.
I appreciate that, but is the calculation of the confidence interval for all sizes or cutoff where it's done, is that part of the software package or is it up to the discretion of whoever leases the software?
Maybe this is getting off track here a little bit, but, you know,
I don't think so.
I'll try, though. One of the things with, and maybe this is up to us to decide, but one of the things with ETGs is there are, folks that will, license the ETG software, which basically gives you, episode results, which then people will take and use for different applications, including physician measurement, and those folks, could make decisions on sample size, et cetera. The same thing that there are other software vendors out there who embed ETGs within their software and use that for their purposes. So there's some flexibility in how they would do it. In our own application of ETGs, which was guiding the measure here, we provide a threshold of 30 observations for a certain measure, of which we are arguing that you probably don't even want to put any weight on it. And then on top of that, we'll suggest the use of confidence intervals. So there's a level at which is it even worth saying this describes the practice of a physician. And then on top of that, meaning that you even should be putting something out there. Then on top of that, the assessment of what's the sort of confidence interval around whatever you're going to propose.
Thank you, sir. That was very helpful.
Yep.
Okay. Other questions on feasibility? 4D in particular. All right. Well, if not, we're not voting the way we voted in the face-to-face because that just, as I understand it, we don't really have the set up to do that and then report the results back. But we do have the ability to go on the SurveyMonkey, and I think the suggestion of staff was that is everybody at a computer and can do this? That now is the best time to render a judgment on the thing, or you can write it down and go later, but I would suggest we take 30 seconds and go ahead and do that. Is there any objection to that?
Well, so we have
not at all.
Just
a question for staff. This is Bill again, Tom. On 9-5, there's only an up and down vote. It doesn't have the four elements. Is that intended?
Correct.
Well, 9-9 does have all four elements of...
that is correct.
Well, for 1595, you already rated, for 1595 and 1599, you rated at the in-person meeting on importance, scientific acceptability, and stability. So you should only need to vote. So,
There are two votes that are left, as I understand it, for both 99 and 95.
Right.
Feasibility, high, moderate, low, insufficient, not applicable. And then we will have to vote overall. Thumbs up or thumbs down to recommend acceptance. But what's on the table right now is the feasibility, and there should be a feasibility screen on both 99 and 95. Ashley, is there?
They're different.
There's a separate link for each measure.
Right.
So in the email, you should have a link for 1595 to rate your feasibility. And so the difference is, if you recall, 1599 was the non-condition specific measure, so you were acting as a TAP. So we asked that you vote, you rate each of the sub-criteria for that measure.
Right.
An overall feasibility and then an overall recommendation.
All right, that's why the screens look different. Okay.
Oh, I see. So 1599 has the subcategorizations, A, B, C, and D.
Right, because the steering committee was the TAP for that measure.
How come? Right. Was there some reason?
Because that was a non-condition specific measure.
Oh.
Right.
Okay.
So I know it gets complicated. So for the 1595, the TAP already rated the sub-criteria, which is what we have on the screen.
Right.
And we're only asking the steering committee to do the overall feasibility and then a final recommendation for that measure.
All right. Well, let me ask one last question. Does the committee feel that the issues are sufficiently same between
feasibility on the non-condition specific one and the diabetes one, that they do not need to be separately discussed, or is there any sense in which they're substantively different?
I think they're the same.
I do too, but I just, thank you.
Great.
Okay. So we can, but it is the case that 1599 requires a rating of the submeasures, and then
right.
and then an overall rating of feasibility. So people want to take a minute to do that, and then we'll have a quick discussion on how what we want to do, how we want to discuss overall approval or not.
That's good.
Okay, so I'm going to do it, and I'm going to judge how fast I can do it, and by when we need to start talking again.
So which one are you going to start with?
I'm starting with 1599, but as we've just discussed, the issues we're viewing the same, so presumably people would vote the same way on both of them. Again, if we value internal consistency, that should be the outcome.
Yeah.
There was a big if there in front of that.
And the cost issues come up in 4E?
The cost issues come up in...
Well, there should be a 4D as in dog. If there's an E, that's probably a typo.
No, there's A, B, C, D, and E on 1599.
A, B, C, and D. I'd have
instead
to look at that. There's four, though. The last one that's E should probably be a D. So that four...
No, there are five ones on here. There's A, B, C, D, and E. And E is the one that we've just been discussing with the cost issues.
Cool.
D was susceptibility to inaccuracies. C was says exclusion should not require extra data. B is the data elements are in electronic sources. And A is that the data elements are routinely generated. I think C is new and doesn't jibe with what we've been talking about.
That's a mistake.
What do you want us to do with C? Just ignore it?
Not applicable.
Not applicable on C. Okay.
Thank you.
I'm sorry, which one was this?
C. For 1599, 4C should be scored in A.
Okay.
And then this also is slightly different because the scoring here is C, P, and M, which I guess corresponds to high, medium, and low.
Yep.
All right, so when you do that, you then get, and you click OK, you then get to the endorsement recommendation screen.
Wait. Tom,
I'm not going to move ahead until people are all ready.
Yeah, well, I'm looking at, it's high, medium, and low, but there are, in fact, four categories here, completely, partially, minimally, and not at all. So M, minimally, and N, not at all, would both qualify as low under... high, medium, low vote?
Unfortunately, I clicked to the next screen, and I can't.
Oh, I'm sorry. So I just double-checked, and the surveys that we sent apparently have not been updated correctly. I apologize for the confusion. Can we just have you guys check it? We'll do another pause in about 10 minutes maybe and have you go back in, and it will look exactly the way you expect it to look. So just give us 5 minutes to fix it, and we'll revisit it. So if everyone could just X out, and then we're going to fix it. And, again, sorry for any confusion on that.
All right. Ashley, just as a process check, I don't believe we're going to get through both 1591 and 94 today in the time. We're bad time management on my part, but
that's fine because the discussion, as you said, if it would apply, the next two measures that we're discussing are both from NGENIX, so it does somewhat overlap and bleed into the discussion time that
okay.
we had a lot
all
of
right.
those measures.
We still may not get to both of them, but I think we want to do justice to all of these. But Ashley, I think there is one other staff work that though is going to have to be done for us to successfully though then vote on our overall recommendation, which is. Can you go back and give us what our ratings were for importance, reliability, and usability?
Yes, for
each of these.
Yes.
For 1599 and 1595.
Yes. So we've got, we do have it on the screen here. Let me pull it up. So for $15.99, what I'm showing on the screen is the steering committee's ratings that you submitted at the in-person meeting.
Okay, so that's the subunits for one. And then what was the overall vote on importance?
That's for importance. The overall vote on importance was that it met importance.
Okay, but what was the vote? Just can you get us the vote?
Yes, hold on 1 second.
Okay.
And Tom, this is Helen. Just keep in mind, obviously, you don't have the full committee, so it's just kind of a straw man, really,
right.
Today, because obviously everybody on the committee will get to vote as we summarize the discussion.
Right. Right.
So, you know.
I understand, but,
okay.
You know. I assume for, again, those of us on the phone would want to be reminded of how we voted on the submeasures. If we voted low on all the submeasures, it would be a little silly 2 weeks later to then vote the thing or vice versa.
Oh, I agree. I'm just saying in terms of just, you know.
I get it.
In real time, right.
But I would also suggest, if in fact, as you're pointing out, Helen, everybody gets to vote.
Yeah.
Making the subunit votes available to the other people as they go to vote on overall acceptability would be a good idea.
Okay.
Yeah, we're pulling it up now.
So they will hear this conference in theory.
Assuming they're willing to sit through an hour of us.
Well, yes and no. Because we would also actually summarize the discussion for them. So they shouldn't have to just listen, although captivating as it has been.
Thank you, Helen.
Liar.
Yeah, there was no sarcasm there. Now, the discussion, I think, has actually been very helpful on all of these. I have a much better sense of this within the basis of the discussion.
I actually wasn't being sarcastic.
You're well placed in your job, then.
So for importance, the overall vote for $15.99 was 16 yes and 0 no.
Okay, terrific. And then do you have scientific acceptability?
Yes. The overall rating
was
9 yes and 6 no.
Okay. And usability?
Usability was 10 moderate and 5 low. And I'm also showing the up on the webinar for scientific acceptability was a distribution of the scientific acceptability ratings. And
okay.
Then,
oh, yes, I see all six of them.
Right. And then for...
where validity testing was the major one that didn't score well, the others scored moderately well.
Right. And then for usability, I'm now showing the distribution of the sub-criteria for $15.99 on usability. And your overall rating for the usability criteria was 10 moderate and 5 low. That was your roll-up of usability based on what you see on the screen.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
And while I assume you're still trying to fix the screens on the SurveyMonkey?
Yes.
Do you want to give us the...
when they're ready, yes.
Yeah, and do you want to then, while we're waiting, give us the scores on 1595?
Yes. So, again, this is the importance rating. This was from the TAP, what I'm showing on the screen now, the distribution of importance. And the steering committee's overall rating of importance at the meeting for 1595 was 18 yes and 0 no.
Okay.
The distribution for scientific acceptability on 1595 from the TAP is what you see on the screen. It may be a little bit behind, but it should be showing up shortly.
All right, so these are the sub-breakdowns, 1, 2, 3, right. 4, 5, 6, 7.
And for the steering committee's overall rating on scientific acceptability for 1595, it was 10 yes and 8 no.
Okay, and then usability.
And then usability. Usability, again, what you see on the screen is from the TAP, and the steering committee's overall rating of usability at the in-person meeting for 1595 was 9 moderate, 6 low, and 3 insufficient.
Okay.
And we can send these slides out to everyone, and we will also have the overall ratings for each one as well, especially for those who aren't on the call today. We want to make sure they have the benefit of this information as well. So
The detail may be fascinating to people, and they want to plow through all the detail, and it's nice to have it pre-screened. The other folks won't have the benefit of you there pre-digesting it. When we say show us X, it appears. So the summary thing, though, I think really would be helpful to people and to highlight that.
Okay, great.
All right, so how close are we to being able to do this?
I think we need a few more minutes on that. Any chance we can start with 1591?
Yes.
Yep.
All right, let's start on 1591, which is a ETG-based congestive heart failure resource use measure, again from NGENX. I don't have anything further to summarize it. I think we should move quickly to the TAP review on this. And Jephthah, can you do that for us?
Yeah, I'll try and do it justice. We had it yesterday and still probably processing exactly what was said. And we had, a smaller TAP number, so, you know, we didn't have as wide a range of opinions on that. I have not seen the TAP score. So, Ashley, you have that for us as we go along, correct?
Yeah, we're going to bring them up on the screen.
Okay. So I think, probably the easiest thing is to dispense with importance. I think that everyone agreed that heart failure and resource use within heart failure population is important. So really...
Yeah, agreed. Just move on to scientific.
To do that. So in terms of scientific acceptability, the application for all the NGENX measures is really similar in terms of describing the techniques. And so there's nothing fundamentally different about any of the data handling, processing, et cetera, that's different for this than any of the other measures. So, again, I'm not going to spend a lot of time going through that. What is different and what probably warrants some consideration and certainly was on the discussion for the TAP yesterday was that this is a measure of systolic heart failure. There's a paired measure of diastolic heart failure that they did not submit, but there is within their portfolio of measures, the two measures for diastolic and systolic. So the greatest amount of discussion was really in specifying or how clearly specified these codes were and how good they are at capturing systolic heart failure. I think we considered it from the standpoint that we could only consider the information that's available to us for evaluating the measure. We couldn't take into account the existence, really, of the diastolic measure. So there was some concern as to the completeness and accuracy with which this measure would capture systolic heart failure. So I can give you some specific examples of that. If you go within the data dictionary, the primary diagnosis codes, they're really specifically limiting themselves to the 428s that use the word systolic in them. They don't use some of the 404s and 402s that other measures have used to capture the larger heart failure population. So I think there was some concern that was giving a limited view of a heart failure population and that was the decision that they made. There was disagreement on the TAP individuals on the TAP expressed concern about that approach.
And Jeff, in the scoring on the scientific, either where was the concern around that reflected in the scoring?
Because I have not seen the scoring, so I cannot tell you what that is, but let me, is it up on the screen?
It's up on the screen.
Okay, sorry. Let me go back here.
Because the only one I'm seeing that didn't that scored low was 2B5, which is identification of statistical meaning, significant meaningful differences,
mm-hmm.
which doesn't sound like the coding concern that you're raising.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'm just saying, trying to reflect back on what the conversation was.
Right.
And I think there are more scores here than there were people on the call. So, again, there may be opinions that are in here that weren't necessarily reflected on the calls, you know, the people who submitted their scores after their own review.
Right.
You know, I can just speak for myself and my own score. That was really in the validity testing of it. I think we also spent some time concerned about the risk adjustment approach, again, using the stratification and the severity levels. And there were TAP members who were particularly concerned that they were adjusting for comorbidities identified during the measurement episode as opposed to comorbidities identified prior to. And there was concern that you would be potentially over-adjusting or adjusting away for significant differences. I'm sorry.
NQF, why is the count of the votes vary by question? 2B1, there's only 5 people voting. For some of the others, there's 9 people voting.
Anybody have an answer for that?
I assume it's the vagaries of SurveyMonkey would be my guess, and the completeness with which people submitted.
Yeah, this is just what we had from SurveyMonkey, so if there were people who did not answer questions, that could be reflected here.
Okay, that's the answer to that. I think our process requires us to consider reliability first and then validity and then the combo. So, Jeff, shall we open it up for discussion?
I think that's meaningful. But let me just focus. Then we'll eventually get to 2B, which is where there was a wider range. 2B5,
okay.
Right? Okay.
If you're all right with that.
Yeah, of course.
Okay. So let's talk about reliability, and it's open for discussion.
So to start, the TAP reflected that the measure is precisely defined, defined in a way that it, and has been used in over a large period of time, and that they did demonstrate that if you do the measure in the same population at the same time, that you'll get the same results. So from the standpoint that the codes are precisely defined, yes, we felt it measured or met that metric.
All right, but that is the question. So to the extent that the codes are defined, but that was an area of some concern, but it wasn't reflected, at least in a TAP vote, of anything less than a moderate
correct
score on the thing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Discussion? Everybody ready to move on? In the absence of a complaint, Jeff, go ahead then with the validity.
So for validity, these measures all, as the other measures have, they rely heavily on face validity, I believe. There's not a lot of validity against a gold standard. There were definitely some concerns about the validation. They weren't paramount as reflected in the voting here. I'll leave it at that. It was a fairly muted discussion about the validity of the measure.
Okay. Open for discussion on validity.
Still doing the stratification for with and without drugs?
Yes.
And no mental health, not explicitly dealt with.
I think everything is identical to what we discussed.
Let me ask. With diabetes, I'm concerned about mental health because of the high level of comorbidity of depression with diabetes. As a non-clinician, what should I understand about mental health and CHF?
I think that it would be identical. certainly there's lots and lots of literature about the high prevalence of depression.
Depression. It'd be virtually identical.
Okay. Well, except that the mental health treatment causes diabetes, where not necessarily CHF.
Right. I missed that. Say
well,
that again.
So some of the antipsychotics are cause metabolic disorder, right?
Oh, in terms of being an etiology for the disorder.
Yeah. Right. Seems right. Like there's more concern there.
You don't have a causal relationship here.
Yeah.
I'm just trying to understand how much the measure could be missing important costs without the carve out being explicitly dealt with.
Right. It seems to me, Jack, at the health plan level, which again is one of the attributions of this.
Right.
Comparisons within a health plan are going to be probably valid because the carve-out will be exactly the same or virtually the same or likely to be the same. It's comparing across health plans or across physician groups or something like that where these issues are quite relevant.
Yeah.
Hey, Tom, this is
yes.
Is it appropriate for me to ask a question?
Absolutely, of course. I'm saying this is completely open for discussion.
I had heard Jack had brought this up before. I do agree with him on the importance from a bunch of different perspectives of the mental health data, but as specified, we're specifying that you have mental health data available to support this measure. So is this more of a feasibility issue or than validity?
Yeah, from my perspective, we've been dealing with it as a feasibility issue, not a validity issue. But since validity is about what's measured, I thought I'd ask the science question here.
I know it's the right. I agree with your question. Just in terms of, I would say based on the way we specified it, and we'd want people to use it, you would have the mental health data available.
Ashley, in turn, this is Jeff. Just on the scores that we're seeing, were these summarized scores over the two phone calls under which we discussed the measure? Or did you zero out the ones from the first call and redo it based on yesterday's call?
I think if any member had resubmitted a score, we used the scores from yesterday.
Okay, so there's no double counting.
Just wanted to confirm.
Okay.
Okay, is there any further discussion on either reliability or validity?
No.
All right, as a point of order, how do people want to handle going on SurveyMonkey? Do you want to plow through all usability and feasibility now and then sort of jot down your own notes and then go to SurveyMonkey, or do you want to quickly do a SurveyMonkey on these as we go?
I got it open. I'm working on filling it out. I hope we get through it before the hour's over.
All right. Well, then my suggestion is let's go and do the scientific piece of this thing right now. And I would also note that I've looked back and 1595 and 1599 have been fixed. So let's take a minute and deal with all three then. Let's deal with the two. 1599, 1595, and now scientific on 1591.
Well, does that make sense? I mean, shouldn't we just take
it? No, I don't think it makes sense.
People would rather just keep going?
Yeah, some of us voted and we're done with the.
Okay, all right, I'm fine with that, and then we can vote at the end and people can do it however they want. I would note that the other two have now been fixed, and so there is clarity about the same scoring measure way that we have been doing. Okay, so we now have the question on 1591 of usability. So, Jeff, do you want to take us through that?
Let me just finish. I'm sorry, because we didn't really discuss the. Can you go back a couple of slides there, Ashley or Tarun?
Oh, I apologize.
So there was 2B5, which I don't think we really discussed.
Oh, I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. Let's spend a minute on that.
One of the concerns was that there really was, in the application, no demonstration of statistically significant or meaningful differences across groups. So they outlined an approach to it in terms of how they would statistically test that, but there was really absolutely no demonstration of how that would work in practice. And I think that's reflected in the low scores that you're seeing there, that it's really a black box at this point as to, you know, when they're calling something statistically significant different, is that clinically significant? And, you know, so there was a fair amount of concern about that particular issue. Now, they did say that they would not be able to get this today, but that they might be able to do these runs within the CHF measure and provide that at a later date.
That's the same issue we had with the ABMS measure here.
Okay. Any comments on that? All right. Seems to be factually accurate. Although, did not we hear from Ingenix in talking about one of the earlier measures that they, in fact, were able to put confidence intervals around the measures?
I think they did in a response, right, Tom?
Yeah,
pardon
Dan.
Dan.
Is Dan still online?
Yes, I am.
Do you want to make a comment about that, about your ability to put confidence intervals around the various numbers?
Yes, that is. I believe that was our general response. I think we followed up with the formula that we use when we do that, if that's the question.
That is the question. I think, Jephthah, that's the question, right?
Yeah, it's that and just demonstration of what that would look like in practice.
Okay, so even though they say they have confidence intervals,
right? I mean, calculating
you've never seen them.
That's not the hard part,
right? It's how do they get used? And okay, all right. I think that's correct. All right,
NQF folks, this is David. I'm in that 1599 SurveyMonkey. It just keeps looping on me. I fill it out. I say I'm done. It just goes right back to the beginning again.
Yeah, mine says 1591 and 94 voting at the same time.
And there's no question 4 in 1591 and 1594.
Okay, why don't we try this? Because we're obviously having some issues with the SurveyMonkey. I want to really use the real estate of the time that we have on the phone call to go through the discussion, and we'll try to do our best to have the SurveyMonkey ready for the end of the call.
All right, I think that's fair. So let's wrap up the discussion around scientific acceptability. Does anybody have any further conversation or questions for Jephthah, the TAP, or comments referable to either reliability or validity? Okay, can we talk about usability?
So with regards to usability, there was really not a lot of discussion about the specific measure. We discussed it a fair amount in terms of the diabetes measures and within the steering committee, the non-condition specific measure. The rationale, the demonstration of the usability of the measure was identical across, I believe, all the applications. And so, you know, there wasn't a lot to add to that based on this particular measure of CHF. So there is demonstration of or statements stating how individual customers or consumers are using this data, but not specific to heart failure.
All right. Can I ask you a question? So your TAP results are on the screen?
Okay. Yep.
All right. So a pretty wide divergence of opinion, it appears.
Right, and I think that had to do, I'm not sure how consistent that is with our previous measured votes on the diabetes one, although I think it was probably a wider range. I think that, you know, a lot of insufficiency, and I'm not sure, what are the blues indicators are not applicable? I think a lot
those
of that,
are
those are kind of just the, you know, that it wasn't specific to heart failure.
Yeah, I got it. And then was there a reason why 3B doesn't have any scoring?
I don't know. I know. I thought we voted on everything.
I'm pretty sure you did. It's probably we used the Excel tool to transfer the scores, and it probably just got lost in translation. We can pull it up, though.
Again, they were, you know, they've been working within 24 hours to turn these scores around.
I'm not being critical. I was just asking.
I think
no criticism implied, other than the fact that this one's important in the sense that measure results are meaningful, useful for public reporting and quality improvement.
Mm-hmm. So I think basically it's a transposition error. I think 3C is actually 3B and 3D is 3C. What's currently listed as 3D, the harmonized, that's not applicable. So we weren't even asked to vote on that, as I recall. Is that right?
That's the one that's generally not applicable. We voted 9-10. You know, every vote on that one has been.
Right. So I think if you just shift everything to the left, I think that would be how it should be transcribed.
Well, here's the diabetes one.
Yeah. So our test retest is not great.
It's not grossly different, but your point is still well made. Well, let's open this for discussion about usability.
Can we go back to the CHF slide?
Ashley, can we go back to the CHF one? But I think she put up the diabetes one because it is probably these are similar enough that while the scores aren't identical, they're not the inverse of one another. So I think certainly some consistency, pretty good consistency. But discussion about usability, usability.
Now we're switching to 1595, right? Ingenix diabetes.
No. She just put the scores up on that one because we didn't seem to have complete scores for 1591 from the TAP.
I think it was slide 13. I think you just passed by it again.
Yeah, you're right.
I see. We're using that instead.
We just used that as kind of a frame of reference of how they were thinking of usability in these various Ingenix ones, given that the CHF one is conceptually similar, if not the same idea.
Right.
Okay, and so we just don't have the TAP score on 3B.
Well, I think you do, but I think it's currently graphed as 3C.
All right, but then we don't have 3C.
Well, I think that's 3D because
I don't think that's right.
You're right.
3D is the one that's not
in
A.
You're correct.
So we either don't have 3B or we don't have 3C. I think D is the one that basically is in A.
Mm-hmm.
Open for discussion. All right.
So we're talking about which? Feasibility?
Yeah. No, this was usability.
Usability.
And that's the TAP score that you can see on the thing, other than that we don't have the measures are meaningful or useful for public reporting, although we saw that same TAP score for the diabetes measure, which, again, had a fairly wide spectrum of opinion from the TAP.
I mean, personally, what I think is most useful is actually looking at the steering committee vote on the usability of the diabetes measure is probably the best barometer for consistency.
Okay.
Because, again, it is identical.
All right. Well, that's fair enough. And if we recall on that one for diabetes, it was none high, nine medium, three low, and three insufficient.
Right.
Okay. And that probably isn't terribly different than the TAP if we were to decompose those various scores.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Any discussion on the substrate or the meat of the usability question? Okay, I think we've hammered the themes pretty thoroughly on that. So let's move to feasibility. And Jeff, I guess we could possibly shortcut this one a little bit. Are the feasibility issues any different than they were on 1599 and 1595? 100%
identical.
Okay, identical. So does anybody want to spend any time rehashing that? Okay.
Don't think it's necessary.
I don't either. Thank you, guys. I would say that we have completed this, and at least the discussion. We still have the vote, and hopefully the tool will have been fixed by the time we're done. And hopefully people are taking some notes as to what their thoughts are and how they're leaning towards voting. So let's put up 1594. And this one is an Ingenix coronary artery disease measure. I assume it's fairly similar conceptually to the others, only now on coronary artery disease. Let's stipulate that it's important. And Jeff, if you could give us the tap on scientific usability, and then we'll, again, talk get through those.
I think that the overall issues were identical. In fact, we basically deferred discussion on most of the individual criteria, just saying that we'd have to conceptually vote the same way on both. The major approach to this one is the key to this one is, again, in the identification of the target population. And this is a little different than heart failure, perhaps just because of the wide variation in the risk of the patients included in the measure. They identify patients for the primary anchoring diagnosis codes are the 410s through 414s. And within that strata, as you know, there is very chronic, stable coronary artery disease through to patients with cardiogenic shock complicated by a flail mitral leaflet. And so there's a huge spectrum of risk of adverse outcomes in that population and would also carry with that the risk of different resource use.
Did your group then weigh in on whether that was reflected in some difference of opinion about risk adjustment?
I think it generally was reflected in the risk adjustment, would be my guess.
Ashley, can we bring up the Category 2 scores from the tap on the screen?
Yeah, I think that should be it, right?
Yep.
Now, again, you're seeing even smaller votes here because this was discussed just yesterday and it was not discussed over two settings, which is, I think, why you had 7 or 8 votes.
All right. You've got the statistically meaningful differences, although the risk adjustment scores of the three people who voted on it weren't all that bad. Right. But I hear your discussion of that was a concern that
right.
was slightly different than the diabetes or the non-specific measure.
And something we suggested to the developer that they go back and demonstrate proof of concept that this is, in fact, accurately accounting for differences in the population.
Okay. All right. Well, there's a fairly small number of votes, and I'm not sure putting the usability and feasibility scores up are going to be terribly useful. But the 1594 then is open for discussion.
Jeff, is it your assessment personally as chair that the issues are the same for 91 and 94? Pretty much.
I think that for all of the Ingenix measures, I think the overarching issues are really the same. Personally and professionally, I think that there is more concern for me on this one than there is in the diabetes and the heart failure. As you get to a wider swath of differences in the underlying risk of the population, I think it's harder and harder for these measures to work effectively. And
totally
I think
agree.
This is sort of the extreme example of that.
Agreed.
Okay. Other questions either for Jephthah or open comments for the group?
So you're worried there's insufficient, you know, it's a scientific question about whether they're really, these episodes are really hang together as homogeneous things that can be compared.
I mean, they're homogeneous in the sense that all these patients have presumably obstructive coronary artery disease, or for the most part. But it's just that if I'm physician A and I happen to get a patient with cardiogenic shock who ends up with an LVAD, is it possible that that their approach to risk adjustment could account for that difference? And I would argue absolutely not.
Yeah, I think we had the same issues. Wasn't there a nondescript CAD measure from the American Board Group, and we had the same set of questions?
Right. But I think the risk adjustment in the Ingenix measures is a little, I don't know. I thought it was a little less robust even than that.
Okay. That's not so good. Okay. Other discussion
Let me just clarify. It's simply because they're going through five different risk strata or four or five different risk strata, and that's all really they're adjusting, not adjusting for, but putting into different categories.
Okay. All right. Great. You want to? Are the usability or feasibility questions then any different either?
Absolutely not.
Okay. And then, Ashley, we had a statistical review on all of these that I forgot to bring up. Is there anything that you recall from that's really relevant?
Is Carlos on the call by any chance? I think he was. Is he there? No. Okay.
And unfortunately, I think I've deleted the email that had it, so I can't even comment. But I did read it this morning, and at least on the statistical of validity part, I think they raised the same concerns that the TAP did.
One more question, Ashley. My SurveyMonkey has concurrent voting for 9-1 and 9-4. Does anyone else have the same screen?
Yeah, there's a drop-down box where you would select which measure that you're going to...
Well, I started out just doing 9-1, but I went to the next screen and both of them are lumped.
I think that's
just
the title. It's just the title of the survey that says that, but the actual, depending on what measure you selected in the first question, that's what measure comes through.
Yeah, I think this is, it would be good to be consistent and just have one measure per one survey and not use this drop down. I think it induces confusion. But
We're obviously having a little trouble still with the voting. I'm seeing that we have 5 minutes left on the call. Does the group that's on the call feel that they have the information or their input to the discussion on these measures that's sufficient to make a judgment?
Yes.
Tom, this is Tarun. I have the statistical evaluation in front of me. Do you want me to go through it in 2 minutes?
I think it was similar for all of them, and if you could just kind of just quickly go through it, I think that would be helpful.
Okay. So some of the summary for this is, I'm using 1591 as an example, but I think your assessment is correct that you can use this across, that the measure was submitted for implementation across various levels of analysis. Individual clinician also, where Carlos noted that sample size may be an issue and they just submitted guidelines. Some additional considerations were that additional details on the statistical model, specifically the goodness of fit and the R-squared values, was provided. And the approach to determining the high and low outliers and the choice of cutoff points needed more explanation. And the measure developer should have provided or should have performed some sort of split sample validation statistical model. Some things that Jepta pointed out also, but I'll just add to, is the risk adjustment methodology was described, but there was, in his opinion, insufficient detail about the specific techniques that were used. And I think other than that, a number of the topics were discussed. So I'll just leave it there.
Okay, well, that's helpful, and I think it does validate the TAP concerns or reiterates the TAP concerns.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any further discussion on any of these? And if not, can we consider our discussion on the four measures for today complete?
Actually, Tom, this is Dan, just as a point of clarification, we did respond to that statistical report with some follow-up on the areas that were asked. I don't know if they find their way back to adjusting it, but I think we answered a lot of those questions.
Tarun, can we make sure that was that follow-up available to the TAP?
So the follow-up information on 15, on which measure was that, Dan? Are you talking about 1595 or 1599?
I'm sorry, I lose track. Maybe let me say this. If you need, I know we followed up on at least a couple of them. And I think
diabetes for sure, Dan.
Yeah, diabetes for sure. If you need exactly the same type of information and you don't have it, we're happy to do so. Some of them were more just a description of what we did, which applies across all measures, and things like the R-squareds would be measure specific.
Right.
Okay.
Diabetes information was provided. It was part of the packet that information we provided at the in-person meeting for 1595. If you remember, we did discuss the bulk of that at the in-person meeting.
Oh, that's right. Of course we did.
And 1599 as well. Now, as discussed yesterday with Tom Lynn on the phone, we did identify some items that there may be some additional follow-up needed, and based on how the discussion went today, we said we would regroup and see whether or not the steering committee wanted and the TAPs needed that additional information for the R-squared and so forth. Is that correct, Tom?
The R-squared for CHF and CAD
could
be provided.
Right, okay.
Okay. So, Ashley, we are obligated to do a brief public comment.
Yes, let's go ahead and do that. Operator, Gwen, if you're there, if you could just open the lines to see if there's anyone who would like to make a comment to the committee.
All lines are open at this time.
Okay.
I think we have fulfilled our duty to the public comments.
Yes, and if everyone, as Tom said, is okay with voting, I apologize for the confusion with the electronic tools. Again, we're trying to do a quick turnaround on these, and we've encountered some errors there. So I apologize for the confusion, but it appears now that we've fixed everything. And if you would like to go in now at the end of the call and do all of your voting, you should be able to do so. The link, just to clarify, for the 1591 and for 1594, the evaluations for both of those measures is in one survey. And depending on which measure you select in the dropdown on the first page, that is what you're evaluating for the rest of the survey. And it loops you back to the beginning so that you can vote on the other measure in that dropdown. So, the survey is titled 1591 and 94, but depending on what you select in the dropdown is actually what you're evaluating at that point until you get to the end of the survey. So,
right. And when I've done the other ones myself and I got to the end and I clicked next, which normally would finish it, it circled me back to the beginning. Did I have confidence that my vote, my scores were then counted, or do I have to keep doing? Okay.
Yes, you should feel confident.
And then when you finish the second, and both of them, they say 90%. I don't know what that means, but...
All right. Well, look, if the scores make no sense, they'll tell us, and you'll send us an email.
We can ask the staff to confirm that our votes are complete on those.
That would be great.
We will send a follow-up email to everyone and let you know what the results of the voting was. Keep in mind, though, that we do have some people who aren't on the call today. We're going to send a follow-up email to everyone today to kind of recap and provide the information to them so they can actually submit their votes, and then we will submit send out a follow-up email to everyone when we have all the votes in with what the actual final recommendation was.
My point is not the final recommendation, just to make sure we have a record of everyone that thinks they voted here.
Right.
And will you send us the results of our vote from today or not?
Individually, is that what you mean?
No. Well, I mean, will there be a tabulation of the nine of us who were voting today, or will you not produce any tabulation until, quote, all the votes are in?
We can produce a tabulation. Actually, we can do that in the follow-up email that we send, just to say for the nine people that were on the call, this was the preliminary results. We can do that.
I think that'd be useful, understanding that it's completely preliminary.
Okay, yes. We can.
Actually, I'm brain dead. Let me ask a simple question. Do you have a record of my vote, this Bill Rich?
I don't have access to the, unless I change screens right now and show everyone.
You'll tell us tomorrow or the next day, Ashley.
Yes,
okay.
Ashley, give us a little time. I've got to digest a few more things before I vote.
Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
We are giving you guys until next week to complete it. So, especially like I said, for the people who aren't on the call, we're giving people additional time to do it. So you're not under the gun to do it right this minute.
Well, but there would be some virtue of the nine of us who were on the call trying to get votes in by, say, tomorrow or Friday, so that, in fact, we could discern whether or not what we did registered. And it's fairly rapid feedback based on the discussion, because, again, I find linking up the scores and how then the votes, how we discussed it, to be instructive.
Right. There's definitely some benefit in it being fresh. I agree.
Right. And if too much time goes by, we forget the thing, and we're trying to, again, this is helpful in creating some internal consistency. I think we've done it. We got through our agenda, and it's precisely 5 o'clock Eastern time, 2 o'clock Pacific. So unless anybody has any other items, Ashley, is there anything else we need to do?
Nope, that's it. We'll just follow up via email, and our next meeting of the steering committee will be the in-person meeting in August.
Ashley, can you send out a copy of the slides from this presentation?
Yes, I can.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for your
thanks, everybody.
Have a good weekend.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Yeah, thank you.